This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. 8:35 in the morning. Now I'm Khoo Soo Chong, joined by Brian Fernandez and Tan Cheung Han. We saw news that MMC has made certain overtures, I think, to consolidate its port assets. And I think all this is quite an interesting consolidation, given the fact that within a few months, hopefully, I think, according to the timetable, they might be applying to the regulators for a IPO of their port assets. What have you got on that news?
Well, basically, Sabah Port's owner, which is Surya Capital, is in talks with MMC Corporation to take a stake in the company. Now, Sabah Ports has a 30-year concession with commenced in 2004 to manage and operate 8 ports in the region, in Sabah itself. Now, MMC, what's MMC's interest in this? Well, MMC owns other ports. It owns 70% stake in PTP, or Pelabuhan Tanjung Pelepas, that's in Johor. It owns the Tanjung Beruas port in Malacca, Johor port, North port, Penang port. So literally, what this story is all about is about consolidation. I think it's also about bringing value overall and efficiencies as well for MMC.
Mm. Now, if this IPO goes through, I think it'd be certainly quite the potential get for shareholders here, because, you know, if you are to subscribe to this notion that external trade, right, global demand, we have seen that double-digit on-year growth for our external trade, at least for the first 5 months of this year. You know, perhaps that will translate into the performances of these respective ports, right? Now, just to give you another point of, just to give you some point of comparison here. So I'm looking at West Ports right now. So looking at the net income for the financial year 2016, it was at 637 million ringgit, okay? 637. That is a far, you know, that's a big gain compared to what they saw in the previous year, 2015, 505 million. So 505 in 2015 up to 637 million ringgit. So one has to wonder whether, you know, West Ports' performance is indicative of how these other ports will fare, you know, in the coming future.
For Sabah Ports itself, just to give you a number, they are up 21% from last year. Mm. So obviously, this is a trend overall within Malaysian ports itself. And for Sabah itself, you know, the potential, of course, of opening up the East Malaysian market further. They've just, I think recently, the cabotage trade was basically abolished, so it's open season for everyone. So this is part of that overall strategy to facilitate trade.
You guys play Monopoly, right?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah.
Okay. So you know how, like, if you want, like, you know, a recurring income, you buy the water company, the electricity company,
yeah.
You buy the 4 train stations, and then every time someone lands on it, depending on how many stations
you have,
it's exactly like that.
Mm.
What Tan Sri San Mokhtar Al-Bukhari is trying to do with this particular exercise, and don't forget that the ports division is actually run by Tan Sri Chek Khalib, who, as you know, used to run Tanaga National, right?
National.
So he knows all about utilities and how utilities perform. So the thing is, now investors are now wondering, with the advance of MMC's port business, which is supposed to come to the public markets 2018, 2019, could raise as much as $700 million, according to the Wall Street Journal, right? Now, Tan Sri San Mokhtar has got port of Tanjung Pelepas in Johor. They've got Penang Port up north. They've got North Ports in Klang, I think. They will now have Sabah Ports. But the thing is, the question that everybody is asking, if you're a fund manager, what do? Do you take money away from West Ports? And don't forget, West Ports is only one terminal in Klang. Where they handle fewer TEUs than all San Mokhtar's ports assets together, but they make more money. Mm. So it's a bit like, you know, how that Felder thing versus the United Plantations thing?
Yeah.
More efficient, more consolidated. What do? Do you migrate funds across one side? What do you do, right?
No. Adding to that, you know, the prospects of that massive Kerry Island port and the kind of capacity expansion that they're expecting down in Singapore, also in Penang, up in Thailand as well, whether or not that will dilute the kind of presence that these existing ports have, right? I guess to put into monopoly terms, it'd be like adding more boxes. And so it just, you know, and you've got the same number of players, right? You know, then, you know, do they, again, you know, does it dilute the kind of presence or the kind of earnings power for these respective ports? Ports, right? I mean, because the Kerry Island port there was massive. If and when it comes online, you know, what's Sabah Port or some of these or North Port, you know, going to do, right?
Talking about asset reshuffles, now let's move on to the National Power Company, Petronas. Now, they, as you know, we they have dialed back their investment in Canada, and they are adding assets in other parts of the world. So they've done stuff in Brazil, they've done stuff in Mexico, and also in India, Brian.
Yeah, so India is the fourth largest LNG market in the world, and in 2016 made up 100,000 tons of Petronas petrochemical sales volume. So what Petronas is also doing besides the LNG business is investing $150 million over the next 5 years to strengthen its lubricant business in India. So they obviously see that India is a big growth potential for them, just as they pull back away from Canada and invest heavily in Brazil and Mexico.
It's very interesting because you know how the oil market now is under huge pressure from a price perspective. Now, what maybe Petronas is trying to do here is do two things. Migrate into the non-oil side of the energy sector, and they also be moving to the, or maybe putting more of their pawns into the downstream sector. Because margins presumably are better there.
Yeah, well, but the project that they're involved in, not just in Brazil, but also in Mexico, I believe they just won another block. Off of the coast of Mexico recently, adding to the two that they won last year. You know, it shows that they are still very much, you know, in the oil game, right?
Yeah, that's an exploration. That's a deep water exploration, the Mexico block.
Yeah, no, but certainly, you know, well, at least the theme that I'm getting from these stories here, be it in India or Brazil or Mexico, is that, hey, no Canada, maybe no problem, you know, for Petronas. Looks like they're still well diversified. They've got that, you know, expansive geographical footprint and, you know, certainly tapping into the growth across various regions in the world.
And here we are halfway through August. I think in about 2.5 months' time, the budget 2018 is going to be announced by the finance minister. It's going to be very interesting how Petronas' assets reshuffling is going to enable it to pay dividends to the government, because you know, obviously Petronas is a big contributor to the government's coffers as well as the country's coffers. Now, this is all very interesting because the ringgit-dollar story has been an ongoing theme. Weak ringgit, strong dollar. And in the wake of all that happened in terms of Bank Negara's prudential measures to address the ringgit's decline, yesterday it emerged that Singapore Exchange has actually introduced a new ringgit's futures contract, which kind of goes against the grain of where Bank Negara sits on its macroprudential measures. Han, you will be talking to Nizam Idris. He's the head of strategy and fixed income and currencies with Macquarie Bank in Singapore. He's on the line to talk to us about this, precisely this issue.
Good morning, Nizam. All right, so the Singapore Stock Exchange and also the Intercontinental Exchange Futures Singapore, they have rolled out that ringgit futures product. What's your initial take on this new derivatives product?
Morning, Han. Well, to me, I think it's a decent step at providing the market with a hedging tool. Basically, what you need is a tool that moves on sentiment, driven purely by market participation. Therefore, you know, you would consider that as a better indicator of risk. And with free access, right? You don't want a hedging tool that may also be curbed by policy changes. So it is not so much a hedge if you can't access the hedge itself. And finally, I think the main challenge for now is to provide enough liquidity for the product. And if liquidity were to increase, then the bid-ask spread would narrow, and that would actually also reduce the cost of hedging. And so I think, you know, this is a decent step at providing a hedging tool. We already had this in Chinese yuan, for example. And this is also, you know, for the same reason that, you know, there is no real access into CNY for foreign investors. Likewise for the ringgit. So yeah, I think it's quite a reasonable tool in my opinion.
Nizam, we saw the ringgit take a bit of a dive down yesterday. I think close somewhere around 429 half levels to the dollar. How much of that was due to the new ringgit futures contract out of Singapore?
Well, I think it's very difficult to make a clear-cut call on where that weakness is coming from. It may have been a factor, but I wouldn't think it's a big factor. Well, I mean, the domestic market may somewhat be impacted by external market as well, because, you know, they're somewhat linked, right? But what's important here is that yesterday there was also the big factor elsewhere in which the dollar strengthened broadly, driven by geopolitical risk, and emerging market currencies weakened across the board. So which is the main driver is very hard for me to say. And yesterday was a particularly noisy day to make that call.
Yeah, speaking about noisy though, no, we had Ben Negara also saying that the ringgit futures, those are inconsistent with its policies and rules. So how much do you think that warning from the central bank will go towards dampening demand of this product?
Well, I don't think it will dampen the demand for the product. Well, for me, I think this is likely to be a product that external investors, foreign investors would be very interested in. Bank Negara has no control of such products. Obviously, there can be some negotiation between, cross-border negotiation between two regulatory bodies. But that aside, I think there is a lot of justification for a currency or rather a product like this. And as I mentioned earlier as well, we already have a similar product for the Chinese yuan. And for any currencies that have, restricted access, I think that product, that there is a decent justification for the product. So I think the market may take some time to warm to the product, but I don't think it will be a significant hindrance given how Bank Negara view it.
Well, how do you read demand for the product given the fact that there's two markets for the ringgit now? One is the onshore cash market in Malaysia, and one, of course, is the other one, the OTC market like the NDFs and this new ringgit futures contract out of Singapore. Specifically, Nizam, what's your sense of where the ringgit will be by this time next year, a year later, and how much of a spread there's going to be between the cash market and the OTC market?
Right. There has always been two separate markets in the past when we are talking about the non-deliverable forward and the domestic deliverable forward for the currency anyway. So to that extent, this is not new. And there will definitely be a spread between the two, simply because of differences in demand and supply. So this is a demand and supply mechanism which, in my view, like I said earlier, if there is some speculative interest in the market, then here we are referring to the ringgit futures market. Then you will get deeper market participation. You will get better movement in the ringgit futures to reflect risk. Meanwhile, the domestic market is largely driven by corporate demand, domestic players with very little, if any, speculative demand, and therefore you get much slower movement in the domestic market.
All right, Nizam, thanks so much for your time. That was Nizam Idris, Head of Strategy and Fixed Income with Macquarie Bank in Singapore. We've got to take a breather now. Come back with some after some messages. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Khoo Soo Chong, and I'm, of course, joined by Brian Fernandez and Tan Chung Han. Now, this story emanating from Singapore about corporate governance and regulatory oversight, company called Noble Group, this commodity trader. Now, 6 years ago, gentlemen, this company was worth about $10 billion on the Singapore Exchange. Today, it's worth $345 million. Now, of course, this comes in the wake of a second quarter earnings, which showed that it had a huge loss. And some 2 or 3 years after initially activist research firms like Iceberg and Muddy Waters pointing out the possibility of financial mismanagement at the business. Now, what do you guys make of this? Huge troubles lie ahead for shareholders here.
Well, basically, this whatever the Muddy Waters and Iceberg have been talking about 2 years ago has essentially played out according to the playbook they mentioned. Now, what the loss or net debt of Noble Group has increased from $940 million to $3.81 billion in the last 6 months ending of June, largely due to credit constraints as well as writing back, restating some of their 2015 and 2016 earnings.
Yeah, it's a huge $2 billion loss for the first 6 months.
Yeah.
As if the sector is in trouble. It's because of structural issues within the business.
Exactly. Because if you look at the sector, say, looking at Glencore right now, Glencore has announced a four-fold jump in its first half adjusted EBIT and also lowest net debt levels in 5 years. That's for Glencore. Looking at Rio Tinto, another commodities, major player over there, they just announced a $3 billion dividend and a share buyback. Looking at Newcastle also, you know, their fortunes are doing well, right? So you've got Glencore, Rio Tinto, Newcastle all doing well. But then when you look at what Noble is going through, $2 billion loss.
But basically, this is consistent with what Iceberg Research has said before, that they fabricated their profits by inflating the value of their contracts in billions of dollars.
So to what extent should the Monetary Authority of Singapore, as regulators of the exchange, should be culpable or potentially culpable? Because this report from Muddy Waters and Iceberg came out a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Should investigations have taken place? Should Noble have been allowed to raise more money in the public markets?
No, and absolutely, because there's shocking lack of oversight, because SGX and MAS, or Singapore Stock Exchange, and the Monetary Authority of Singapore allowed Noble Group to raise $500 million from equity shareholders in June 2016 and $750 million in bonds in 2017. So, who was sleeping on the watch here?
Could have been everybody, but it's not the first time that Singapore has had some corporate governance issues. I mean, we just saw recently, in fact, some years ago, that small cap saga. Unfortunately,
yes, Asia
Suns, Bluemont, debacle begun by Malaysian trader Dr. John So.
Yeah, not just that, but also what we have learned from in the wake of the 1MDB saga, right? You know, the likes of Falcon Bank and all these other bankers who are now being prosecuted for their involvement in that financial trail right there. Where was the corporate governance level? Where was the compliance? Where were the compliance guys at these respective banks? Right? Where were they? I think that's a question mark. It took a Wall Street Journal report for the Central Bank of Singapore to then only react, So, yeah, it looks like Singapore, at least the MAS, I guess we can, we're kind of safe on this side of the border, like, we can say this.
Well, at least, some sentencing has occurred. Essentially, some people have been made culpable.
Right, but after the fact.
But at least they did something. So, glass half full. talking about corporate governance and moving to the tech space, now Facebook have launched a video service. It's actually going to be called Watch, okay? Now, this is interesting because they're going to be moving away from depending on content generators slowly, and they're going to be doing a Netflix. They're going to be generating their own content on their own video platform. Now, this is a sign of a great pivot, unlike, say, a Snapchat, for example.
Well, because the thing with Facebook is how they've been able to pivot. If you remember, just 3 years ago, more than 80% of their, in fact, 89% of their revenues were basically from web-based advertising. And then they did the pivot to mobile. And mobile is now their main contributor to advertising. Here they are again now, moving again to the video space.
Right, and they're signing deals where you can live stream football matches, you can live stream baseball matches in the States. And so it looks like, the question will be, are you going to watch, right? And it looks like they are mounting this direct challenge against the likes of YouTube now, where we are entering this video streaming and video servicing space, right?
And Disney as well. So Disney on the 9th of August, that was yesterday, day before yesterday, announced that it would end its partnership with Netflix in 2019 and start its own service. So the space is really hotting up in terms of competitors.
Yeah, I mean, when you consider they've got, 2 billion users? 2 billion
well,
users?
When you combine... They bought Instagram.
That's a lot of eyeballs, aren't
they bought Instagram for $1 billion in 2012. Now Instagram has, it's a runaway success. It doesn't have the youth profile of a Snapchat. Everybody kinda has an Instagram.
You had to say that because you're on Instagram.
I got videos of Sherrod dancing on my Instagram account.
Okay. Nobody watches.
So when you combine Instagram 600 to 700 odd million users, when you combine WhatsApp's 1 billion users, which it bought for $19 billion, I think four years ago, and you combine its own 1.7 billion users, Facebook has about half, give or take a couple hundred million people, the global population. Now, that's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, and don't forget their foray into virtual reality as well, right? So you've got that, ramping up, and that could be another huge catalyst for growth there. So, when you see what Facebook is doing, when you see what Google is doing, what can Snapchat do? What can Twitter do? I mean, come on now.
Yeah,
how do you compete, right?
Well, the trouble with Snap is that they haven't really, explored beyond the very young profile of their demographic. And that's all come true because they've just reported second quarter earnings. And on every single metric, whether it's earnings per share loss, whether it's on revenue, whether it's on average daily users, they've missed. They closed yesterday trading $11.91, record low, just a few weeks after the IPO.
But you see, Chuang, you've got to temper that with a pinch of salt, because essentially their revenue was at $181 million US dollars. It's up 153% from the corresponding period.
But they were
ago.
Expected to grow, you see. Yes. They were expected to grow more than that.
Yeah, so they added 7 million users, which the market was expecting them to do 8 million users. So they are growing at a slower pace than market expected, but they're earning
money. I tell you what is growing really fast at Snapchat.
The loss.
No, burn rate.
Yes.
They used to burn through 150 million a year. Now they're burning through 225 million a year.
And you know what I find hilarious in all of this? The shareholders cannot do anything about it.
Because of the dual class.
It's
a three-tier structure, you
see.
It's a three-tier. You know what they can...
You can't vote. You can't do anything.
What they can't do, cannot do, is oust Evan Spiegel, right?
Right.
Because of the class structure. But what they can do is they can sell, because on Monday, the moratorium following the IPO is lifted.
Ah.
And you're going to expect there's going to be more dumping.
Like this coming Monday.
So basically, some of the investors and some of their employees who basically were had the lockup period,
right,
are able to sell.
But I think Spiegel has come out to say, no, we're going to calm the markets. He's not going to sell even if, you know, he was allowed
what
to.
What he might do is posture the business for a takeover. Who knows, right? Okay, guys, 8:58 in the morning. We're going to be coming back from the Bursa with daily prices, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.